The Gulag Archipelago, 1918 to 1956. An experiment in literary investigation by Alexander I. Solzhenitsyn. Translated by Thomas P. Whitney. Copyright 1973 by Alexander I. Solzhenitsyn. English language translation, copyright 1973-1974 by Harper and Row Publishers, Incorporated. This recording of the reading of the Gulag Archipelago was published by arrangement with Harper and Row Publishers, Incorporated, and was produced in 1989 by Blackstone Audiobooks, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any part thereof may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authority from Blackstone Audiobooks, Incorporated. The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 1. This volume is 615 pages long and contains two parts. The prison industry, which consists of 12 chapters, and perpetual motion, which consists of 4 chapters. The volume will be read in 2 sections. The first will take us through chapter 6 of the prison industry. The second will pick up with chapter 7 and take us to the end of volume 1. And now, the Gulag Archipelago, Volume 1.
The following material appears on the dust jacket of the book. It is a question if any work of literature in our era, other than the Divine Comedy, is commensurate with the Gulag Archipelago in structure, scale, multiplicity of incident and characters, emotional range, variety of inflection, and above all in the staggering magnitude of its underlying concept. In this masterpiece, the author of One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich and the First Circle has orchestrated thousands of incidents and individual histories into one narrative of unflagging power and momentum. Written in a tone that encompasses Olympian wrath, bitter calm, savage irony, and sheer comedy, it combines history, autobiography, documentary and political analysis as it examines in its totality the Soviet apparatus of repression from its inception following the October Revolution of 1917. The archipelago of Mr. Solzhenitsyn's work is the network of secret police installations, camps, prisons, transit centers, communications facilities, transportation systems, and espionage organizations, which in his view honeycombs the length and breadth of the Soviet Union. Drawing on his own experience, material from Soviet archives, cases collected during his 11 years of labor camps and exile, and the evidence of more than 200 fellow prisoners, Mr. Solzhenitsyn concludes that the secret police are the vital element of the Soviet regime and have been ever since its founding by Lenin. Numerous studies of the Soviet system of control have been published in the West, but until now nothing so complete, so carefully documented and assembled, and never before has a literary giant devoted his gifts of narrative and characterization to the enterprise. Solzhenitsyn has here created and peopled with brilliantly portrayed human beings a vast, overarching fresco of that state within a state, which is the Gulag Archipelago. Thomas P. Whitney, the translator, has also translated both One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich and The First Circle, and is a leading authority on Russian culture and the Soviet Union. There is a dedication at the beginning of the book as follows. I dedicate this to all those who did not live to tell it, and may they please forgive me for not having seen it all, nor remembered it all, for not having divined all of it. Author's note. For years I have, with reluctant heart, withheld from publication this already completed book. My obligation to those still living outweighed my obligation to the dead. But now that state security has seized the book anyway, I have no alternative but to publish it immediately. In this book there are no fictitious persons, nor fictitious events. People and places are named with their own names. if they are identified by initials instead of names, it is for personal considerations. If they are not named at all, it is only because human memory has failed to preserve their names. But it all took place, just as it is here described. Preface. In 1949, some friends and I came upon a noteworthy news item in Nature, a magazine of the Academy of Sciences. It reported in tiny type that in the course of excavations on the Colima River, a subterranean ice lens had been discovered, which was actually a frozen stream, and in it were found frozen specimens of prehistoric fauna some tens of thousands of years old. Whether fish or salamander, these were preserved in so fresh a state, the scientific correspondent reported, that those present immediately broke open the ice encasing the specimens and devoured them with relish on the spot. The magazine no doubt astonished its small audience with the news of how successfully the flesh of fish could be kept fresh in a frozen state. But few indeed among its readers were able to decipher the genuine and heroic meaning of this incautious report. As for us, however, we understood instantly. We could picture the entire scene right down to the smallest details. How those present broke up the ice in frenzied haste. How, flouting the higher claims of ichthyology and elbowing each other to be first, they tore off chunks of the prehistoric flesh and hauled them over to the bonfire to thaw them out and bolt them down. We understood because we ourselves were the same kind of people as those present at that event. We, too, were from that powerful tribe of Zeks, unique on the face of the earth, the only people who could devour prehistoric salamander with relish. And the Colima was the greatest and most famous island, the pole of ferocity of that amazing country of Gulag, which, though scattered in an archipelago geographically, was, in the psychological sense, fused into a continent, an almost invisible, almost imperceptible country inhabited by the Zek people. And this archipelago crisscrossed and patterned that other country within which it was located, like a gigantic patchwork, cutting into its cities, hovering over its streets. Yet there were many who did not even guess at its presence, and many, many others who had heard something vague, and only those who had been there knew the whole truth. But, as though stricken dumb on the islands of the archipelago, they kept their silence. By an unexpected turn of our history, a bit of the truth, an insignificant part of the whole, was allowed out in the open. But those same hands which once screwed tight our handcuffs now hold out their palms in reconciliation. No, don't. Don't dig up the past. Dwell on the past, and you'll lose an eye. But the proverb goes on to say, forget the past and you'll lose both eyes. Decades go by, and the scars and sores of the past are healing over for good. In the course of this period, some of the islands of the archipelago have shuddered and dissolved, and the polar sea of oblivion rolls over them. And some day in the future, this archipelago, its air, and the bones of its inhabitants, frozen in a lens of ice, will be discovered by our descendants like some improbable salamander. I would not be so bold as to try to write the history of the archipelago. I have never had the chance to read the documents. And, in fact, will anyone ever have the chance to read them? Those who do not wish to recall have already had enough time, and will have more, to destroy all the documents down to the very last one. I have absorbed into myself my own 11 years there, not as something shameful, nor as a nightmare to be cursed. I have come almost to love that monstrous world, and now, by a happy turn of events, I have also been entrusted with many recent reports and letters. So perhaps I shall be able to give some account of the bones and flesh of that salamander, which, incidentally, is still alive. This book could never have been created by one person alone. In addition to what I myself was able to take away from the archipelago, on the skin of my back, and with my eyes and ears, material for this book was given me in reports, memoirs, and letters by 227 witnesses, whose names were to have been listed here. What I here express to them is not personal gratitude, because this is our common collective monument to all those who were tortured and murdered. From among them, I would like to single out in particular those who worked hard to help me obtain supporting bibliographical material from books to be found in contemporary libraries or from books long since removed from libraries and destroyed. Great persistence was often required to find even one copy which had been preserved. Even more would I like to pay tribute to those who helped me keep this manuscript concealed in difficult periods, and then to have it copied. But the time has not yet come when I dare name them. The old Solovetsky Islands prisoner, Dmitri Petrovich Vitkovsky, was to have been editor of this book, but his half a lifetime spent there, indeed his own camp memoirs are entitled Half a Lifetime, resulted in untimely paralysis, and it was not until after he had already been deprived of the gift of speech that he was able to read several completed chapters only and see for himself that everything will be told. Part 1. The Prison Industry. In the period of dictatorship surrounded on all sides by enemies, we sometimes manifested unnecessary leniency and unnecessary soft-heartedness. Krylenko, speech at the Prompt Party trial. Chapter 1. Arrest. How do people get to this clandestine archipelago? Hour by hour, planes fly there, ships steer their course there, and trains thunder off to it, but all with nary a mark on them to tell of their destination. And at ticket windows or at travel bureaus for Soviet or foreign tourists, the employees would be astounded if you were to ask for a ticket to go there. They know nothing, and they've never heard of the archipelago as a whole, or of any of its innumerable islands. Those who go to the archipelago to administer it get there via the training schools of the Ministry of Internal Affairs. Those who go there to be guards are conscripted via the military conscription centres. And those who, like you and me, dear reader, go there to die, must get there solely and compulsorily via arrest. Arrest. Need it be said that it is a breaking point in your life, a bolt of lightning which has scored a direct hit on you, that it is an unassimilable spiritual earthquake not every person can cope with, as a result of which people often slip into insanity. The universe has as many different centers as there are living beings in it. Each of us is a center of the universe, and that universe is shattered when they hiss at you, "You are under arrest." If you are arrested, can anything else remain unshattered by this cataclysm? But the darkened mind is incapable of embracing these displacements in our universe, and both the most sophisticated and the veriest simpleton among us, drawing on all life's experience, can gasp out only, "Me? What for?" And this is a question which, though repeated millions and millions of times before, has yet to receive an answer. Arrest is an instantaneous, shattering thrust, expulsion, somersault from one state into another. We have been happily born, or perhaps have unhappily dragged our weary way, down the long and crooked streets of our lives, past all kinds of walls and fences made of rotting wood, rammed earth, brick, concrete, iron railings. We have never given a thought to what lies behind them. We have never tried to penetrate them with our vision or our understanding. But there is where the Gulag country begins, right next to us, 2 yards away from us. In addition, we have failed to notice an enormous number of closely fitted, well-disguised doors and gates in these fences. All those gates were prepared for us, every last one. And all of a sudden, the fateful gate swings quickly open, and 4 white male hands, unaccustomed to physical labor, but nonetheless strong and tenacious, grab us by the leg, arm, collar, cap, ear, and drag us in like a sack, and the gate behind us, the gate to our past life, is slammed shut once and for all. That's all there is to it. You are arrested. And you'll find nothing better to respond with than a lamb-like bleat. "Me? What for?" That's what arrest is. It's a blinding flash and a blow which shifts the present instantly into the past and the impossible into omnipotent actuality. That's all. And neither for the first hour nor for the first day will you be able to grasp anything else. Except that in your desperation the fake circus moon will blink at you. It's a mistake. They'll set things right. And everything which is by now comprised in the traditional, even literary image of an arrest will pile up and take shape, not in your own disordered memory, but in what your family and your neighbors in your apartment remember. The sharp nighttime ring, or the rude knock at the door, the insolent entrance of the unwiped jackboots of the unsleeping state security operatives, the frightened and cowed civilian witness at their backs. And what function does this civilian witness serve? The victim doesn't even dare think about it, and the operatives don't remember. But that's what the regulations call for, and so he has to sit there all night long and sign in the morning. The regulation, purposeless in itself, derives, N.M. recalls, from that strange time when the citizenry not only was supposed to, but actually dared to verify the actions of the police. For the witness, jerked from his bed, it is torture too, to go out night after night to help arrest his own neighbors and acquaintances. The traditional image of arrest is also trembling hands packing for the victim, a change of underwear, a piece of soap, something to eat. And no one knows what is needed, what is permitted, what clothes are best to wear. And the security agents keep interrupting and hurrying you. You don't need anything. They'll feed you there. It's warm there. It's all lies. They keep hurrying you to frighten you. The traditional image of arrest is also what happens afterward, when the poor victim has been taken away. It is an alien, brutal and crushing force, totally dominating the apartment for hours on end, a breaking, ripping open, pulling from the walls, emptying things from wardrobes and desks onto the floor, shaking, dumping out and ripping apart, piling up mountains of litter on the floor, and the crunch of things being trampled beneath jackboots. And nothing is sacred in a search. During the arrest of the locomotive engineer Inoshin, a tiny coffin stood in his room, containing the body of his newly dead child. The jurists dumped the child's body out of the coffin and searched it. They shake sick people out of their sick beds, and they unwind bandages to search beneath them. When in 1937 they wiped out Dr. Kazakov's institute, the commission broke up the jars containing the lysates developed by him, even though patients who had been cured and others still being treated rushed around them, begging them to preserve the miraculous medicines. According to the official version, the lysates were supposed to be poisons. In that case, why should they not have been kept as material evidence? Nothing is so stupid as to be inadmissible during a search. For example, they seized from the antiquarian Chetverukin a certain number of pages of Tsarist decrees, to wit, the decree on ending the war with Napoleon, on the formation of the Holy Alliance, and a proclamation of public prayers against cholera during the epidemic of 1830. From our greatest expert on Tibet, Vostrikov, they confiscated ancient Tibetan manuscripts of great value, and it took the pupils of the deceased scholar 30 years to wrest them from the KGB. When the Orientalist Nevsky was arrested, they grabbed Tangut manuscripts, and 25 years later the deceased victim was posthumously awarded a Lenin Prize for deciphering them. From Karger, they took his archive of the Yenisei Ostiaks and vetoed the alphabet and vocabulary he had developed for this people, and a small nationality was thereby left without any written language. It would take a long time to describe all this in educated speech, but there's a folk saying about the search which covers the subject. They are looking for something which was never put there. They carry off whatever they have seized, but sometimes they compel the arrested individual to carry it. Thus, Nina Alexandrovna Palchanskaya hauled over her shoulder a bag filled with the papers and letters of her eternally busy and active husband, the late great Russian engineer, carrying it into their moor, once and for all, forever. For those left behind after the arrest, there is the long tail end of a wrecked and devastated life, and the attempts to go and deliver food parcels. But from all the windows, the answer comes in barking voices. Nobody here by that name. Never heard of him. Yes, and in the worst days in Leningrad, it took 5 days of standing in crowded lines just to get to that window. And it may be only after half a year or a year that the arrested person responds at all. Or else the answer is tossed out, deprived of the right to correspond. And that means once and for all. No right to correspondence. And that almost for certain means has been shot. In other words, we live in the cursed conditions in which a human being can disappear into the void, and even his closest relatives, his mother and his wife, do not know for years what has become of him. Is that right or not? That is what Lenin wrote in 1910 in his obituary of Babushkin. But let's speak frankly. Babushkin was transporting arms for an uprising and was caught with them when he was shot. He knew what he was doing. You couldn't say that about helpless rabbits like us. That's how we picture arrest to ourselves. The kind of night arrest described is, in fact, a favorite because it has important advantages. Everyone living in the apartment is thrown into a state of terror by the first knock at the door. The arrested person is torn from the warmth of his bed. He is in a daze, half asleep, helpless, and his judgment is befogged. In a night arrest, the state security men have a superiority in numbers. There are many of them, armed, against one person who hasn't even finished buttoning his trousers. During the arrest and search, it is highly improbable that a crowd of potential supporters will gather at the entrance. The unhurried step-by-step visits, first to one apartment, then to another, tomorrow to a third and a fourth, provide an opportunity for the security operations personnel to be deployed with the maximum efficiency and to imprison many more citizens of a given town than the police force itself numbers. In addition, there's an advantage to night arrests in that neither the people in neighboring apartment houses nor those on the city streets can see how many have been taken away. Arrests which frighten the closest neighbors are no event at all to those farther away. It's as if they had not taken place. Along that same asphalt ribbon on which the black mariahs scurry at night, a tribe of youngsters strides by day with banners, flowers, and gay, untroubled songs. But those who take, whose work consists solely of arrests, for whom the horror is boringly repetitive, have a much broader understanding of how arrests operate. They operate according to a large body of theory, and innocence must not lead one to ignore this. The science of arrest is an important segment of the course on general penology and has been propped up with a substantial body of social theory. Arrests are classified according to various criteria, nighttime and daytime, at home, at work, during a journey. First-time arrests and repeats, individual and group arrests. Arrests are distinguished by the degree of surprise required, the amount of resistance expected, even though in tens of millions of cases no resistance was expected, and in fact there was none. Arrests are also differentiated by the thoroughness of the required search. And there is a separate science of searches, too. I have had the chance to read a pamphlet on this subject for correspondence school law students in Alma-Ata. Its author praises highly those police officials who, in the course of their searches, went so far as to turn over 2 tons of manure, 8 cubic yards of firewood, or 2 loads of hay, cleaned the snow from an entire collective farm vegetable plot, dismantled brick ovens, dug up cesspools, checked out toilet bowls, looked into doghouses, chicken coops, birdhouses, tore apart mattresses, ripped adhesive tape off people's bodies, and even tore out metal teeth in the search for microfilm. Students were advised to begin and to end with a body search. During the course of the search, the arrested person might have grabbed up something that had already been examined. They were also advised to return to the site of a search at a different time of day and carry out the search all over again. By instructions either to make out or not to make out an inventory of confiscated property or seal a room or apartment, to arrest the wife after the husband and send the children to an orphanage, or to send the rest of the family into exile, or to send the old folks to a labor camp too. No, no. Arrests vary widely in form. In 1926, Irma Mendel, a Hungarian, obtained through the Comintern 2 front-row tickets to the Bolshoi Theatre. Interrogator Klegel was courting her at the time, and she invited him to go with her. They sat through the show very affectionately, and when it was over, he took her straight to the Lubyanka. And if on a flowering June day in 1927 on Kuznetsky Most, the plump-cheeked, red-headed beauty Anna Skripnikova, who had just bought some navy blue material for a dress, climbed into a hansom cab with a young man about town, you can be sure it wasn't a lover's tryst at all, as the cabman understood very well and showed by his frown. He knew the organs don't pay. It was an arrest. In just a moment they would turn on the Lubyanka and enter the black maw of the gates. And if, some 22 springs later, Navy Captain Second Rank Boris Bukovsky, wearing a white tunic and a trace of expensive eau de cologne, was buying a cake for a young lady, do not take an oath that the cake would ever reach the young lady, and not be sliced up instead by the knives of the men searching the captain, and then delivered to him in his first cell. No, one certainly cannot say that daylight arrest, arrest during a journey, or arrest in the middle of a crowd has ever been neglected in our country. However, it has always been clean cut, and most surprising of all, the victims, in cooperation with the security men, have conducted themselves in the noblest conceivable manner, so as to spare the living from witnessing the death of the condemned. Not everyone can be arrested at home with a preliminary knock at the door, and if there is a knock, then it has to be the house manager or else the postman. And not everyone can be arrested at work, either. If the person to be arrested is vicious, then it's better to seize him outside his ordinary milieu, away from his family and colleagues, from those who share his views, from any hiding places. It is essential that he have no chance to destroy, hide, or pass on anything to anyone. VIPs in the military or the party were sometimes first given new assignments, ensconced in a private railway car, and then arrested en route. Some obscure, ordinary mortal, scared to death by epidemic arrests all around him, and already depressed for a week by sinister glances from his chief, is suddenly summoned to the local party committee, where he is beamingly presented with a vacation ticket to a Sochi sanatorium. The rabbit is overwhelmed and immediately concludes that his fears were groundless. After expressing his gratitude, he hurries home, triumphant, to pack his suitcase. It is only 2 hours till train time, and he scolds his wife for being too slow. He arrives at the station with time to spare, and there in the waiting room or at the bar he is hailed by an extraordinarily pleasant young man. "Don't you remember me, Pyotr Ivanich?" Pyotr Ivanich has difficulty remembering. "Well, not exactly, you see, although..." The young man, however, is overflowing with friendly concern. "Come now, how can that be? I'll have to remind you." And he bows respectfully to Pyotr Ivanich's wife. "You must forgive us. I'll keep him only 1 minute." The wife accedes, and trustingly the husband lets himself be led away by the arm, forever, or for 10 years. The station is thronged, and no one notices anything. Oh, you citizens who love to travel, do not forget that in every station there are a GPU branch and several prison cells. This importunity of alleged acquaintances is so abrupt that only a person who has not had the wolfish preparation of camp life is likely to pull back from it. Do not suppose, for example, that if you are an employee of the American Embassy by the name of Alexander D., you cannot be arrested in broad daylight on Gorky Street, right by the Central Telegraph Office. Your unfamiliar friend dashes through the press of the crowd and opens his plundering arms to embrace you. "Sasha!" He simply shouts at you with no effort to be inconspicuous. "Hey, pal, long time no see. Come on over, let's get out of the way." At that moment, a Pobeda sedan draws up to the curb, and several days later, TASS will issue an angry statement to all the papers, alleging that informed circles of the Soviet government have no information on the disappearance of Alexander D. But what's so unusual about that? Our boys have carried out such arrests in Brussels, which was where Zora Blednov was seized, not just in Moscow. One has to give the organs their due. In an age when public speeches, the plays in our theatres, and women's fashions all seem to have come off assembly lines, arrests can be of the most varied kind. They take you aside in a factory corridor after you have had your pass checked, and you're arrested. They take you from a military hospital with a temperature of 102, as they did with Ernst Bernstein, and the doctor will not raise a peep about your arrest. Just let him try. They'll take you right off the operating table, as they took N.M. Vorobyev, a school inspector in 1936, in the middle of an operation for stomach ulcer, and drag you off to a cell, as they did him, half alive and all bloody, as Karpunish recollects. Or, like Nadia Levitskaya, you try to get information about your mother's sentence, and they give it to you, but it turns out to be a confrontation and your own arrest. In the gastronome, the fancy food store, you're invited to the special order department and arrested there. You are arrested by a religious pilgrim whom you have put up for the night, for the sake of Christ. You are arrested by a meter man who has come to read your electric meter. You are arrested by a bicyclist who has run into you on the street, by a railway conductor, a taxi driver, a savings bank teller, the manager of a movie theatre. Any one of them can arrest you, and you notice the concealed maroon-coloured identification card only when it is too late. Sometimes arrests even seem to be a game. There's so much superfluous imagination, so much well-fed energy invested in them. After all, the victim would not resist anyway. Is it that the security agents want to justify their employment and their numbers? After all, it would seem enough to send notices to all the rabbits marked for arrest, and they would show up obediently at the designated hour and minute at the iron gates of state security with a bundle in their hand, ready to occupy a piece of floor in the cell for which they were intended. And, in fact, that's the way collective farmers are arrested. Who wants to go all the way to a hut at night with no roads to travel on? They are summoned to the village Soviet and arrested there. Manual workers are called into the office. Of course, every machine has a point at which it is overloaded, beyond which it cannot function. In the strained and overloaded years of 1945 and 1946, when trainload after trainload poured in from Europe to be swallowed up immediately and sent off to Gulag, all that excessive theatricality went out the window, and the whole theory suffered greatly. All the fuss and feathers of ritual went flying in every direction, and the arrest of tens of thousands took on the appearance of a squalid roll call. They stood there with lists, read off the names of those on one train, loaded them onto another, and that was the whole arrest. For several decades, political arrests were distinguished in our country precisely by the fact that people were arrested who were guilty of nothing, and were therefore unprepared to put up any resistance whatsoever. There was a general feeling of being destined for destruction, a sense of having nowhere to escape from the GPU-NKVD, which, incidentally given our internal passport system, was quite accurate. And even in the fever of epidemic arrests, when people leaving for work said farewell to their families every day, because they could not be certain they would return at night, even then almost no one tried to run away, and only in rare cases did people commit suicide. And that was exactly what was required. A submissive sheep is a find for a wolf. This submissiveness was also due to ignorance of the mechanics of epidemic arrests. By and large, the organs had no profound reasons for their choice of whom to arrest and whom not to arrest. They merely had overall assignments, quotas for a specific number of arrests. These quotas might be filled on an orderly basis or wholly arbitrarily. In 1937, a woman came to the reception room of the Novocherkassk NKVD to ask what she should do about the unfed, unweaned infant of a neighbor who had been arrested. They said, "Sit down, we'll find out." She sat there for 2 hours, whereupon they took her and tossed her into a cell. They had a total plan which had to be fulfilled in a hurry, and there was no one available to send out into the city, and here was this woman already in their hands. On the other hand, the NKVD did come to get the Latvian Andrei Pavel near Orsha, but he didn't open the door. He jumped out the window, escaped, and shot straight to Siberia. And even though he lived under his own name, and it was clear from his documents that he had come from Orsha, he was never arrested, nor summoned to the organs, nor subjected to any suspicion whatsoever. After all, search for wanted persons falls into 3 categories. All union, republican, and provincial. and the pursuit of nearly half of those arrested in those epidemics would have been confined to the provinces. A person marked for arrest by virtue of chance circumstances, such as a neighbour's denunciation, could be easily replaced by another neighbour. Others, like André Pavel, who found themselves in a trap or an ambushed apartment by accident, and who were bold enough to escape immediately before they could be questioned, were never caught and never charged, while those who stayed behind to await justice got a term in prison. And the overwhelming majority, almost all, behaved just like that, without any spirit, helplessly, with a sense of doom. It is true, of course, that the NKVD, in the absence of the person it wanted, would make his relatives guarantee not to leave the area. And, of course, it was easy enough to cook up a case against those who stayed behind to replace the one who had fled. Universal innocence also gave rise to the universal failure to act. Maybe they won't take you. Maybe it will all blow over. A.I. Ladizhensky was the chief teacher in a school in remote Kologriv. In 1937, a peasant approached him in an open market and passed him a message from a third person. Alexandra Ivanich, get out of town, you are on the list. But he stayed. After all, the whole school rests on my shoulders, and their own children are pupils here. How can they arrest me? Several days later, he was arrested. Not everyone was so fortunate as to understand at the age of 14, as did Vanya Levitsky. Every honest man is sure to go to prison. Right now, my papa is serving time, and when I grow up, they'll put me in, too. They put him in when he was 23 years old. The majority sit quietly and dare to hope. Since you aren't guilty, then how can they arrest you? It's a mistake. They are already dragging you along by the collar, and you still keep on exclaiming to yourself, "It's a mistake. They'll set things straight and let me out." Others are being arrested en masse, and that's a bothersome fact. But in those other cases, there is always some dark area. Maybe he was guilty. But as for you, you are obviously innocent. You still believe that the organs are humanly logical institutions. They will set things straight and let you out. Why, then, should you run away? And how can you resist right then? After all, you'll only make your situation worse. You'll make it more difficult for them to sort out the mistake. And it isn't just that you don't put up any resistance. You even walk down the stairs on tiptoe, as you're ordered to do, so your neighbours won't hear. And how we burned in the camps later, thinking, what would things have been like if every security operative, when he went out at night to make an arrest, had been uncertain whether he would return alive and had to say goodbye to his family? Or if, during periods of mass arrests, as for example in Leningrad, when they arrested a quarter of the entire city, people had not simply sat there in their lairs, paling with terror at every bang of the downstairs door and at every step on the staircase, but had understood they had nothing left to lose and had boldly set up in the downstairs hall an ambush of half a dozen people with axes, hammers, pokers, or whatever else was at hand. After all, you knew ahead of time that those blue caps were out at night for no good purpose, and you could be sure ahead of time that you'd be cracking the skull of a cutthroat. Or what about the Black Maria sitting out there on the street with one lonely chauffeur? What if it had been driven off or its tires spiked? The organs would very quickly have suffered a shortage of officers and transport, and, notwithstanding all of Stalin's thirst, the cursed machine would have ground to a halt. If. We didn't love freedom enough, and even more, we had no awareness of the real situation. We spent ourselves in one unrestrained outburst in 1917, and then we hurried to submit. We submitted with pleasure. Arthur Ransom describes a workers' meeting at Yaroslavl in 1921. Delegates were sent to the workers from the Central Committee in Moscow to confer on the substance of the argument about trade unions. The representative of the opposition, Y. Larin, explained to the workers that their trade union must be their defense against the administration, that they possessed rights which they had won, and upon which no one else had any right to infringe. The workers, however, were completely indifferent, simply not comprehending whom they still needed to be defended against, and why they still needed any rights. When the spokesman for the party line rebuked them for their laziness and for getting out of hand, and demanded sacrifices from them, overtime work without pay, reductions in food, military discipline in the factory administration, This aroused great elation and applause. We purely and simply deserved everything that happened afterward. At what exact point, then, should one resist? When one's belt is taken away? When one is ordered to face into a corner? When one crosses the threshold of one's home? An arrest consists of a series of incidental irrelevancies, of a multitude of things that do not matter, and there seems no point in arguing about any one of them individually, especially at a time when the thoughts of the person arrested are wrapped tightly about the big question, what for? And yet, all these incidental irrelevancies taken together implacably constitute the arrest. Almost anything can occupy the thoughts of a person who has just been arrested. This alone would fill volumes. There can be feelings which we never suspected. When 19-year-old Yevgenia Doyarenko was arrested in 1921, and three young Czechists were poking about her bed and through the underwear in her chest of drawers, she was not disturbed. There was nothing there, and they would find nothing. But all of a sudden they touched her personal diary, which she would not have shown even to her own mother, and these hostile young strangers reading the words she had written was more devastating to her than the whole Lubyanka with its bars and its cellars. It is true of many that the outrage inflicted by arrest on their personal feelings and attachments can be far, far stronger than their political beliefs or their fear of prison. A person who is not inwardly prepared for the use of violence against him is always weaker than the person committing the violence. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.